Headlines.
From Washington, D.C., the capital of the divided states of America, it's time for the show that brings you both sides of issues that really matter. On the right, I am Republican investigative reporter Lee Stranahan.
And on the left corner here, this is Mike Hirsch, rounding out my guest host stint for Garland Nixon. We'll be back on Monday. And I'm the National Communications Director for Progressive Democrats of America. You can find us at pdamerica.org.
Get ready. It's time for the most disruptive radio show in America. It's time for Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan. On today's show, I am joined by guest host Mike Hirsch, who, as he said, is filling in all this week for Garland Nixon. Mike and I will be talking about whether Trump's tough talk on North Korea and against Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is smart strategy or dangerous hot air. In round two, we're going to talk about education, in particular, the future of education and whether our current educational system has outlived its usefulness.
And in honor of Roger Waters, if all in all, it's just another brick in the wall.
That's a good one. We're not going to be singing, though, will we?
No, not this time.
Not this time. And in the third round, we'll be talking in our regularly scheduled end-of-the-week Friday segment on signature stories. President Trump made it real easy last night where he talked about two of these stories we talk about week in and week out here, which are DNC Ukrainian election interference and the refusal of the DNC to let the FBI look at their servers. All in that and more on today's episode of Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan with guest host Mike Hirsch. How you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing great. I have had a great week. I thank you for letting me fill in for Garland and had a lot of fun. Hopefully we informed a lot of people. And
hopefully we're not done because we still have an hour to get through.
We still have one more hour to go. We're only 4/5 through.
I think this will be an interesting show, too, because the education segment, we like to do stuff that's news-based here, and there is a news basis for this education segment, which is an article in the New York Times we'll be talking about, but it's a little broader than that, too. And I don't know if you know this, Mike, but people, especially with kids, seem to care about education.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense.
It does.
And people without kids should also care about education.
I know, but it's hard. They don't. I mean, I'm just being realistic about it. They sort of care about it, but they don't care about it in a visceral. Does that make sense?
It's like, not in their household. It doesn't, hit home, so to speak.
That's right. Yeah. Some of those issues, you have to have kids to get.
Well,
I don't know how else to say it.
You have a whole different experience. It's not, it's not theoretical.
It's like people say about marriage. Unless you've been married, it's very hard to explain. You can sort of explain it, but it's different.
You can't understand it if you haven't experienced it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Anyway, I want to do the usual stuff, let your neighbors know about the show here at Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan. I think we do something interesting and different. You're getting both sides, a progressive Bernie side and a Trump side. If you're listening to us on 105.5 FM inside the Beltway, we welcome you to our terrestrial broadcast. But you can also listen to us at SputnikNews.com. You can listen to us on the app. You can watch us on Facebook Live. Just go to the Sputnik page on Facebook if you like watching radio. Also, you can watch us on Periscope. We're on Periscope right now. To get to the Periscope, go to my Twitter feed, which is at Stranahan. By the way, while you're on Twitter, make sure to follow at Garland Nixon, our normal co-host, and at Mike Hirsch, who is on there as well. And snag a good name. The abnormal host.
Sure.
See, I wouldn't have said that. That would have been
supernatural.
That would have been mean. Supernatural and extraterrestrial, since we're not just on terrestrial radio.
There you go.
But also, you can listen to us on iTunes, where we would ask you to rate and review the show, and on Spreaker. That's the stuff I need to get out of the way to promote the show. So let's talk about, we talked a little bit yesterday, Mike, about this North Korea story, which let's say one thing about the North Korea story. there's a visceral reaction a lot of people have. And And I understand it completely. So
actually, there are more than one. There are a lot of visceral reactions, I think.
Well, I gauge my wife. My wife's a civilian, by which I mean she's not a political activist. She doesn't do this for a living. She doesn't want to do it for a living. She raises our kids, and we have a puppy, and that's what she's a regular person. And she does, and she has interest, and she can talk about politics coherently, but she's not a nut job like I am who researches this stuff 6 hours a day. Does that make sense? And so she's a civilian, and thank God for that, because—
So she's a sounding board for you.
That's exactly right. And so we were talking about this earlier, and she said, well, I didn't want to bring this up, but I'm kind of like petrified about this nuclear war thing.
Yeah, a lot of people were afraid that North Korea was going to attack us, and now a lot of people are afraid that Trump is going to get us into a situation where somebody else is going to attack us.
Yeah.
So it's kind of almost a runaway fear response that people are having now.
Well, and again, the New York Times, the gray lady who sets the front page for the rest of the media, they had a front page story today on how things could escalate. And they said, for instance, let's say we see that North Korea has a missile all set to go. We have satellites. We see the missile, okay? And we know that they're going to send the missile towards Guam, which is the U.S. territory.
Well, they say they're going to. See, I think there's a large gulf between what North Korea claims it's going to do and can do and what they actually can do.
Well, but so here's what the Times said. What the Times said is, let's say we see the missile.
Yeah, assume that they aren't lying this time.
Yeah, assume it's worst case. Assume it's worst case. Now, and they're getting ready to launch it. The U.S. has the capability to go in very quickly and knock that missile out. We could send in jets. We have that capability.
You shoot down the missile?
Right. Let's say destroy the base before it even launches.
Okay, so preemptively.
Yeah, because we do. We
destroy
do have
the missile on the pad.
We do have that. That's not crazy.
We have bases in South Korea.
That's right.
And we have the most extensive military operations that, you know, they call war games or preparations.
That's right.
Where once a year we have B-1 bombers flying around that airspace. So we have an immense military capacity
and
in the vicinity there.
We also have stuff like, remember in Afghanistan a few months ago, do you remember the mother of bombs?
I can see you're starting to get excited just talking about
I'm not, but I just remember.
I don't know. You're getting a glint in your
eye. It's the mother of all bombs.
You're getting excited, I think, a little bit.
Well, I'm saying.
Not as much as maybe the CNN people were.
No.
They were really getting excited.
Although, you know, you talk about visceral stuff. This is true. I worked in Hollywood for a long time. I did a stock footage shoot about 20 years ago. I'm not a gun person. Particularly at that time, I wasn't a gun person. But we did a shoot. We wanted to do stock footage of guns firing. And we brought in, like, automatic weapons, machine guns, with a gun guy whose job it is to keep all that stuff safe.
Like a gun wrangler.
That's exactly—
He knows what he's doing.
We hired a gun wrangler. And my wife and I both were like— He was like, do you want to try shooting him? With blanks.
You're shooting the guns, not shooting
Have you ever shot, like, a machine gun?
I have not. I've shot other guns, but there's
a real visceral. There's a reason places like in Vegas, you can go to shoot a machine gun. There's something very primal.
I know that it gets warm.
It does. Yeah.
It's throwing a lot of metal.
So there is. So if I got a glint, it's not even purposeful. It's just there's
it seldom
something,
is.
There's something very primal about that. But we have like the mother of all bombs. Donald Trump in Afghanistan dropped the biggest bomb that had ever been dropped that's non-nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have that capability. So with the time—
And it wouldn't even require anything quite that big, I don't think.
No.
Because if you look at how a missile is launching, it's very delicate equipment. I would imagine that anything, you could damage it slightly and screw it up completely. You know, it has to be perfectly balanced to operate properly.
And so— What the Times said was that that could set off a huge problem, that even us preemptively doing that is a huge problem. Now, We'll talk about this. By the way, I was trying to play this yesterday. So let me do my breaking news alert and then we'll do it.
Okay, here we go.
Here's my breaking news alert.
It only took us 2 days to get this set up.
It only took a couple days.
It better be good.
It's a very complex technical operation here.
And the guys in the control room are doing a great job. It wasn't their problem.
Yes, it wasn't their problem at all. They're fantastic.
They're the best.
And very attractive as well as well-spoken.
Okay.
So, but here's it is. Now, we've heard a lot of tough talk from Trump. He talked about fire and fury. And then he said that didn't go far enough. And then Korea responded. So I just want to play this breaking news. This is Donald Trump's new message to Kim Jong-un. This has just been released by the White House. Let's play this message.
And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee.
There we go. That's breaking from the White House. I think that's the next lot. By the way, that's not really breaking from the White House.
That was Pulp Fiction.
That's Pulp Fiction. Yeah. But that seems like the next logical step to me, right? I'm not sure where you...
Samuel L. Jackson is the new presidential spokesperson.
Oh, that'd be great, actually.
On Fire and Fury.
That'd be fantastic. Actually, they need...
You couldn't get any better, really.
They need a communications director.
He's awesome.
Yeah.
Samuel L. Jackson. He's just... You know, wonderful actor, one of the best.
I don't know if you know this about Samuel L. Jackson. Here's a trivia note. He curses a little.
A little, yeah. Especially about snakes on planes.
He does.
Especially, but in other contexts as well.
But I would like to see Samuel L. Jackson go in the press room and go, pay attention, Mother Hubbards.
If he could have that
That's
wig,
what I'd,
the wig that he wore in Pulp Fiction, too.
That'd be fine.
And have Travolta there with his arms folded.
That'd be good. And you know who he could have on the other side is the Mooch, Scaramucci.
Yeah.
And he's already got the wardrobe. Yeah, Scaramucci would be good.
Yeah, unfortunately, he's been let go. But maybe he can come back. I don't know.
But so here's the complexity of this. And I like his tough talk. I like Trump's tough talk against McConnell. And I'm actually fine with it in the case of North Korea. Because here's my thing. I don't think anybody's got a great suggestion of what to do about this.
Well, I disagree with you, but if you want to finish
Well,
that
no,
thought.
So what's the great suggestion?
Well, the suggestion that all the countries that are right in the neighborhood, South Korea, Japan, Russia, China, they have the suggestion of what they call a freeze for a freeze, where North Korea will refreeze their nuclear and missile programs if the United States stops holding the massive war games or these exercises that seem to be rehearsing for an invasion of North Korea that the North Koreans find very threatening, as I think is, you know, not unreasonable on their part. And that's one way of moving forward. Another way of moving forward is to go along with what the kind of less belligerent neocons of the Bill Clinton faction would do, where they would also begin to normalize economic and political relations with North Korea in return for North Korea freezing its nuclear program. And that actually was working to some degree, not perfectly, but working to some degree for about a dozen years until the more virulent war hawk neocons of the Dick Cheney variety got in and started causing a lot of problems. But I disagree with trying to bully North Korea. I think that is bound to backfire. It's already undermining the situation that wasn't great to begin with.
But see,
and hold on. I think the situation's the worst that it's been since 1968 when North Korea captured a spy vessel called the Pueblo, and that led to a huge crisis. This is another crisis, although fortunately this is kind of a manufactured crisis. And if Trump, you know, maybe took some sedatives or, you know, took up meditation or yoga and calmed himself down a little bit, maybe we can work through this.
But look, here's the thing. Trump won the election. The people who supported him did not elect him as America's first guru or something like that. We've had that. And I think, first off—
I don't think we have.
You know, you mentioned the Pueblo. Let me just say this. You remember the people, the thing about the Pueblo is, I remember there was a big saying, remember the Pueblo. Remember that? in the 60s and 70s, people would say, remember the Pueblo.
And what's ironic. And then people forgot it.
Exactly right. That's what's ironic, is very few people actually remember the Pueblo incident.
It's also ironic to name a boat after a rock structure. Because you think
that's a good point.
It's not, you know, very buoyant. Seaworthy.
There's a buoyancy issue there.
It's an issue of seaworthiness.
But I think in the case of both McConnell and this Korea situation, first off, North Korea, whichever Kim is in charge there, they're the bullies. And they have been consistently bullies. And so the question becomes, how do you deal with a country that clearly is A, mistreating its own people, which leave that aside. But it's not like he's awesome in any regard.
Right. Well, I don't think that I think, you know, not to defend any of the Kims, this Kim or his father or his grandfather, I guess it is. But I don't consider them bullies because they haven't bullied other countries. They've annoyed other countries.
South Korea and Japan would agree.
I don't think that they felt bullied.
I think they felt
provoked and annoyed.
Well, and let me give you an example. The South Korean leader who was elected recently, he's on the left. He's a lot more progressive than the guy who preceded him. And he was going to get rid of that anti-missile system the United States had put in there. He's changed his mind.
Right.
Now, I think
that's true.
I think he's changed his mind not due to arm twisting from the United States as much as he's seeing what's coming from North Korea.
I'm not sure that that's exactly correct, but I'll stick by this. I don't think Japan and South Korea feel bullied by North Korea. I think they feel that there's a need to address North Korean hostility. But I think that the way they would prefer that Trump and the United States do it is ways that diffuse the situation rather than destabilize an already tricky situation. And that's why I think that Trump and his lack of experience and lack of self-control are making this a bad situation worse. And I'd go back on it. The people in the neighborhood, China, Japan, South Korea, Russia, should probably take the lead on dealing with North Korea. And I think Trump would probably be better off not talking about North Korea at all if he wants to defuse the situation. I would say the reason Trump is wading into this is because he's got a lot of problems. His domestic and foreign policy and other things are falling apart. And this is a great distraction that he's using to confuse people.
I think with both this and McConnell, he's a master negotiator who goes in a position of strength and then is willing to compromise. And we'll see how it works out. In the meantime, like I say, it is causing a lot of tension for people. In round two, Mike and I will be talking about education. You're listening to the most disruptive radio show in America. It's Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan, with guest host Mike Hirsch all this week.
Fault Lines.
We are back with Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan, with guest host Mike Hirsch, the communications director of the Progressive Democrats of America, PDA, here all week. Last two segments with Mike. Mike, thanks again for being with us all week.
Really, my pleasure.
Really appreciate it. And hopefully, once again, we've given people actually some different ideas and also some areas where we've agreed, which is interesting to people. You know, the premise of the show, the premise of Fault Lines was to take a Bernie supporter and a Trump supporter, and it makes the most sense in the world from a commercial standpoint, which is why it's weird nobody else is doing it.
Well, there are reasons that have more to do with things besides what people are interested in.
That's right.
In terms of kind of thought control and, kind of containing what people will discuss and think about.
Well, thought control, that's a good segue for our education
as a matter
segment.
Of fact.
So what I wanted to do was we were going through stories. Mike and I were going through stories for today, and I was looking at the New York Times, as I'm wont to do, because, as Noam Chomsky said, in Manufacturing Consent, the New York Times sets the editorial page the rest of the world. And I don't agree with Noam Chomsky on a lot, but that's clearly true. It's just factually accurate.
I think you might agree with him a lot more maybe than you think.
No, I've read Chomsky, so I don't agree on a lot of stuff, but...
Well, what he does talk about a lot is that in the United States, you get the conversation between A and A prime rather than even A and B, and a whole lot of things go undiscussed.
Well, Chomsky, I got to tell you, this is going to be the nerdiest thing in the world. One of my main differences with Chomsky is he's a linguist as a philosopher. He's primarily a linguist, and I reject the linguist school of modern philosophy, the post-Kantian. See, I told you, it's very nerdy.
Well, what's fascinating about linguists is they study language.
Yeah, right.
And,
yes.
And if you think about what human beings would be like without language, we wouldn't be able to convey philosophy. So while linguists don't have all the answers, and I'll always say that nobody has all the answers, they have a very important insight about how our brains work and how people influence one another through language.
Yeah.
And the structure of language. And then there's things like, you know, in 1984, they were eliminating words to eliminate what people could think about. And it was the newspeak.
Well, by the way, that's one of my reasons. See, and that's the part I agree with. And clearly, people on the left, and Chomsky's part of it, there's a reason a lot of the thinkers on the left end up being linguists or end up being people like George Lakoff, who thinks about framing and stuff like that.
Well, and also, Lakoff predicted that the Democrats were empowering, or he didn't predict, he assessed that the Democrats were empowering Trump by talking about Trump.
Yeah.
So much. So
and this,
he predicted Trump winning because the Democratic strategy was inherently flawed. And I think you might agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I saw that. And that's why, like I say, I read Lakoff. If I'm critical of people, like I am critical of Chomsky, particularly, you know, like his view on Palestine, for instance, I have a lot of problems with that. But without drilling down into the specifics, I read people who I criticize. But this ties directly into what I wanted to talk about. There's a Time story. Headline is, a new kind of classroom, no grades, no failing, no hurry. And this immediately caught my interest. And I know for a lot of people, so I'm going to tell you my background in this and where I come from philosophically on this. And I'm just going to say, from a practical basis, my wife and I homeschool, and we've homeschooled for 20-something. My son Shane, who I think you've met Shane.
I've met Shane, yeah.
Shane's 25 today, turned 25 today. So I can just back time and go, we must have homeschooled about 20 years. So
really 25 years because you start teaching your kids as soon as you...
But we didn't pull them out of school. We pulled them out of the womb at first.
Right.
And then my poor son Jack is sitting here watching. That's the last thing he wants to hear. But nothing about a womb. You don't want to hear that. But anyway, we've homeschooled for about 20 years. And we didn't... And I'm a Christian, but I've only been a Christian for a few years, actually. I came to Christ a few years ago. We didn't homeschool because we're Christians, for instance. We homeschool because my belief is that the education system doesn't do a good job of prepping people. And I did an interview a few years ago with a guy named Seth Godin. Seth Godin's a marketing expert. He's written books like The Dip, like All Marketers Are Liars, and he's kind of a futurist as well. And he and I talked about education. And I just want to play real briefly just a short segment of that interview that I did with Seth Godin a few years ago. And then I want to get your take on it as well, Mike. But I want to give some of the perspective that I bring to this. I think it's a very populist. Anybody who listens to me knows I'm skeptical of government, but I'm also skeptical of big business. I'm both, mm-hmm. both of them. And so here's what Seth Godin said in my interview a few years ago.
In this case, public education was a conspiracy between government and corporations. Corporations were petrified that two things would happen when factories started getting efficient. One, that they would run out of factory workers because that would mean they'd have to pay people a lot. And two, that they would run out of people who wanted to buy stuff.
So that's what Seth said. And it goes on, and we'll post the whole interview over at populist.tv, where, by the way, I'm just going to mention my own site, Populist.tv, every day, Monday through Friday, we post extra stories about the segments that we do here on the show. So if people want more reading, or in this case, more listening, they can always go to Populist.tv and get a little bit more on some of the topics that we talk about. So anyway, that's what Seth said. Now, I played this for you earlier, Mike, and you had speaking of visceral.
Well, I'd like to hear more of what he says, but I think that, you know, one of the things that fascinates me is people who argue by starting the timeline at a very arbitrary point. And I think that he could have made an even stronger point by saying that the education system that we have today is a relic. It developed the academic calendar arose because a lot of families were involved in farming. And so,
right,
school starts after harvest season and ends before planting season. And it's like, you know, most American families are no longer involved in farming.
Yes.
And I have nothing against farmers. I think farmers are great. But it seems like at some point in the past several decades or, you know, even more than 100 years, we could have reassessed this.
Well, he was talking
about that.
What Seth was talking about in that is the Dewey Carnegie era. Yeah,
you mentioned, and that was like before the Depression, right?
It was before the Depression.
So this was quite some time ago.
That's right, where it was basically to train factory workers. And the point that Seth goes on to make is that we're not in that economy anymore. We're not right. We're in an information-based economy.
And I go so far as to say that the Carnegies and the other robber barons of that age, who were very greedy people, were actually less greedy and less short-sighted than the corporate leaders today who, you know, Seth made a point that they were afraid that people wouldn't be able to buy things. It's now, you know, today's corporations, mega corporations, don't care. They pay their people so little that their people are ineffective as consumers, and they're kind of hoping that somebody else will pay their workers more so they can buy their stuff. And it's very short-sighted. It's a race to the bottom, and it's a vicious cycle that's kind of deindustrialized the United States and led to a lot of the economic problems we have now. But the education system is not blameless. The education system has a lot of legacy issues and doing things in ways that they've always done, and that's been exacerbated by a standardized test obsession.
Yes.
And it's been exacerbated by culture wars where people have been using our schools to fight these outside battles that have nothing to do with preparing them for an economic life. And, I just wanted to get this out. This is very important to me. I think that our education system would benefit and desperately needs serious, sincere reforms, not efforts to defund public education as part of the culture wars, but to recognize that we need a vibrant, effective education system for every child in the country, because that's a bedrock American value, because a well-educated populace is necessary for a well-governed country, because we are supposed to govern ourselves. And if we don't know what we're doing, we're not going to do a good job governing ourselves. And I think that the lack of attention to this and the lack of needed massive investments in public education, money, but not just money, upgrading buildings themselves in several areas, pay raises for teachers, and also requiring high effectiveness from teachers, a higher level of effectiveness. So I think that we've got a complex of problems.
Well, so here's my take on it, and I take a different view than most people I know. I don't take the standard Republican line, and I just don't. So here's my take on it. I think, and again, and this is going to go against some of the stuff you're saying, but even Republicans don't go this far. So the problem of education has actually been solved, and it's been solved by technology, which is the individual teacher that you can get. So let's say you grow up wherever you are. What is the likelihood that the math teacher at your school is like the best math teacher in the country? And the chances are 1 in 30,000.
However many
right?
there are.
Right.
Because one of them's the best.
That's right. And probably they're not that great. And probably, in fact, a lot of people who went into teaching weren't subject matter experts, particularly at the elementary school. In other words, they weren't like the best mathematician. They went in for education.
Well, that would be a waste, because if you had the best mathematician trying to teach arithmetic to first graders, that'd be a huge mismatch.
So when I say the problem of education has been solved, this is what I mean. If I want to learn screenwriting from David Mamet or Aaron Sorkin, I can do that right now. There's a thing called Masterclass. I'm not pitching them. I've paid money for them. I don't get anything from them. But it lets you learn comedy from Steve Martin or photography from Annie Leibovitz or whatever, right? Online education, and now at a base level, things like Khan Academy, which are free.
Yeah, I think that you're making some very good points. However, I think that kind of is tangential to the New York Times story and also the fundamental story where, like, kindergarten through, sixth grade.
Yeah.
Is where, people towards, I guess, sixth graders could probably go online and educate themselves. But first you need to teach students the skills to educate themselves.
Here's what I mean by that. First off, kids, I have kids, Jack, who's 16, who's here. Jack has never been to school. Jack's one of those kids who's never been to school. I never attended formally. And my wife and I don't
I'm not saying that they need to learn that in a specific building.
Yeah, no,
but
no.
They do need to learn the skills.
Well, let's talk about the buildings, because I'm also not trying to be anecdotal and going, well, look, my kid's not stupid. Therefore, that's going to work for everybody. Here's one of the problems, and it gets to the buildings. Homeschooling is a lifestyle choice. What I mean by that is my wife doesn't work because she can't work. Because if she were working, she couldn't homeschool her 5- and 7-year-old. What that means is we've given up certain things. Income, clear, right? She's at home with the kids. My job, I've intentionally worked jobs where I can have the kids around. Even when I worked at NBC, the kids would come over to NBC in the afternoons to hang out.
Right, and you have to understand that not everybody has that situation.
That's exactly right. That's the point I'm making.
And we have policy that will be flexible enough to facilitate what you're doing and to allow other people to emulate you if that's their choice and make it possible for them to do that if they want to do that. But we also have to, in a country of 300 million, we have to accommodate people who aren't as gifted as you or your wife are at teaching.
Here's what it has to do with to me. So let's take this, okay? You can buy a basic tablet computer for $40 from Amazon, $49. I just bought three of them, and they were $25 each.
And we're not advertising them. But
I'm not advertising them. I'm just saying this is where the technology's gotten
right to.
Now, by the way, do you know who's scared to death of that? Are textbook manufacturers.
And just, they should be. They're raking in huge,
exactly right,
huge amounts of money.
And I'm not picking on them. I'm just saying this is one aspect of it. Textbook manufacturers, the fact is a tablet is more effective. Kids are carrying backpacks.
More versatile. It's easier to carry.
Have you seen these backpacks that kids carry around sometimes
now? Oh, it's ridiculous.
Now?
It's like a bodybuilding, kid or something.
There are Navy SEALs who are carrying less heavy loads.
Maybe that's what this is. It's secretly a
that's right. It's a
plan for
it's a bodybuilding technique.
North Korea invasion force or something.
But now, so here's the thing. So you can have, so what I'm saying is you could easily afford, for the amount of money you spend on one textbook.
Well, you're absolutely right. And this is just one example of how we need to rethink education.
Yes. Yeah.
And move it into the 21st century, where the children's attention span is different.
Yes.
Their expectations for being stimulated are different. I remember, growing up, we used to watch Saturday morning cartoons, which was basically loud noises and kind of chaotic, colorful images, and we loved that.
Yes.
And then school was deathly boring by comparison for
That's
us.
That's right. Yeah.
Now you compare that to people who walk around with computers in their pocket, and now they have somebody droning in front of the classroom like they've been doing it in the 50s, the 40s, the 30s.
You don't mean a literal drone.
Droning on.
Oh, I see. You mean like the Charlie Brown stuff.
Yeah. Wow.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. So even Charles Schulz was hip to that back in the day.
So
we need to be more entertaining, more engaging, the New York Times was talking about, you know, the way you're talking about it, sounded like some kind of hippie commune thing, but they've actually rethought this, and they're basically getting students to focus on mastering skills.
Right. That's exactly
and
right.
And mastering skills is a lot more important than memorizing facts, which
that's
you will
exactly
then forget.
Right.
And I think that would revolutionize education. It would make it more enjoyable for the teachers and the students, more effective,
and prepare
the students for the 21st century economy where they're going to have to use the technology that you're talking about. Might as well use it to teach them
and what
to use it.
What I picture is not teachers in the traditional sense, but more facilitators.
There you go.
In other words, there needs to be a place for people to go, for kids to go whose parents are working.
Right.
And the other big problem I have with education, by the way, just real quickly, is it's group-based. Individual, people learn individually. So
I think that it's a mixture. I think that, we need to have a hybrid system, but it shouldn't be all one or the other, and we shouldn't be doing it because we've always done it that way.
And that's
exactly why I appreciate
the point,
you. Yeah. You're the kind of conservative who isn't a slave to tradition.
Yes.
And too many conservatives and even too many liberals are slaves to tradition.
And I got to say, I think a lot of liberals, if you ever saw the film Waiting for Superman, which is a great film.
Yeah, a lot of liberals are also slaves to tradition.
They start to realize that the teachers' unions in some ways are part of the problem here because they don't want change
they
either.
They have to be enlisted to do creative thinking into how to reimagine their profession for
That's
everyone's
right.
benefit.
There you go. Coming up in the next round, we'll be talking about our signature story, something we do every week here on Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan. We're joined this week by guest host Mike Hirsch all week. Our final segment coming right up.
Fault Lines. Fault Lines.
We are back, round three, and the final segment of the week here on Fault Lines, where a couple of weeks ago, Mike, we started a new tradition. Because here's the thing about having a show. You can just make up tradition.
That's one of the good things. Yeah.
You could, if we wanted to, we could say it's Fishing Wednesday, and I don't know. Garland would do much better at that segment than I would. He fishes.
Yes, he does.
I hope he's fishing right now. By the way, Garland Nixon, my co-host on the show, Garland Nixon, has been out all week, and Mike's been filling in. Mike is the communications director for Progressive Democrats America. Mike, where can people find more about the group, by the way, if they want to?
You can go online and look up PDAmerica.org. Some people will put in PDA America. That's not right. You want it to be P as in Peter, D as in David, America as in the country we're living in, if you're listening in America.
So that, because if it was PDA America, that would be Progressive Democrats of America, America.
Right. They'd be like ATM machine.
That's right. It's
automatic teller machine.
Redundant Democrats of America, redundant.
Are they? Redundant Department of
Department,
Redundancy.
Department of Redundancy Department. A little fire sign theater there for you. But we've had Mike on all week now. So the segment, Mike, that we do is my idea was that we cover certain – we have – in the same way you'll see cooking shows and they have cooks and they have their signature dish. Have you seen this at all?
I don't really watch a lot of cooking shows, but yeah.
Yeah,
I understand the concept.
I'm going to admit that.
Okay.
And they have their signature dish, so it's, you know, whatever, chicken and waffles.
Coq au vin.
Their mish, right, yeah. So we realized, Garland and I were talking, that we have certain stories we cover all the time. I talk about George Soros on a daily basis, but like this DNC Ukraine election interference story, we've been almost – I won't even say almost. I don't know another media outlet anywhere on the face of this earth. It's true that has covered that story as consistently as Garland and I have. I don't know anybody who's covered the DNC CrowdStrike and the fact that the DNC wouldn't let.
And what CrowdStrike is.
What CrowdStrike is and the fact that the DNC refused to cooperate with the FBI. And by the way, why? You know, I'm a Republican, so it's clear why I would go after the DNC. But why would Garland Nixon, a Democrat, possibly do this? And the answer is these things that we're talking about, in particular the DNC not allowing the FBI to examine the servers and this group CrowdStrike, this was used initially against Bernie Sanders.
Right.
So in other words, I said this today to people. I said, one of the reasons I'm principled is because as a Trump supporter, I want Trump, the president, to be as close to Trump, the candidate, as he is, because that's the way he's going to get elected. What I said was, I said, otherwise, what's going to happen? I said, the biggest difficulty, I said, I see how you could defeat Trump. I totally get it. I think, by the way, and I've said this before, if Bernie Sanders had been the candidate against Donald Trump, I believe Sanders would have won.
That's what a lot of the opinion polls were showing.
Yes. And I really believe that. I believe that, and by the way, I wouldn't have liked that, and so on and so forth.
But I think you might have liked it more than you think.
I might have I would have liked it certainly more than Hillary Clinton. I don't want to get into this, a big systemic problem where I think Sanders, like the short version is, Sanders, like Obama, would have continued the advancement of civil society groups that are on the left, Ford Foundation, MacArthur Foundation, which grew, community activist groups grew hugely under Obama, and that would have continued unabated. And I think there's a risk there, but I don't want to get it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think we can get back on to.
Yeah, but that's what it is in a nutshell, because I talk about that stuff. So,
and I also know why Garland would support discussing.
Yes.
This. I've spoken with him about it. And what Garland and I both believe is that the Democratic Party, the DNC and others, need to start focusing on policies that people need and leave the investigations on the back burner and stop screaming accusations, you know, substantiated or otherwise. They should leave the investigations on the back burners for a lot of specific reasons, because they're not likely to lead to electoral victories, is number one. Number two, even if they do somehow win, if Democrats win by flogging these investigations and scandals, that won't lead to a mandate. And the reason we don't think it's going to be very successful is that we have too many problems and too many big challenges not to focus on things like the climate, fiscal instability, homelessness, deterioration of our industrial capacity, the collapse of our jobs market, economic inequality, and that leads to economic stagnation. Lately, the increasing threat of war, millions of people still not getting health care. And I've mentioned it before, but if people check out the summerforprogress.com, they can find out what a bunch of progressives are telling the Democratic Party to do. And this is an entirely inside the Democratic Party thing, where a bunch of progressives are saying to the Democrats, step away from this all conspiracy, all allegations, all, you know, investigations all the time, and start doing your job, which is to make life better for the American people.
Well, and I think it's part of maintaining, I think it's part of the establishment.
Exactly.
The Republican establishment, the Democrat establishment, and what I'll call the administrative state establishment, which includes groups like the CIA, the NSA, the FBI. In other words, when I say that, I mean groups who, as you know, we've talked about this before.
And the media as well.
And the media. Because here's what it is. Who's going to be president in 2020? I don't know. But here's what I do know. 90-something percent of the people who are at the CIA, the NSA, and all those groups will still be here no matter who's the president. Does that make sense? In other words,
unless
there's somebody, no turnover.
Yeah, unless somebody like Bernie gets in, it's going to be like 90% Goldman Sachs people making the economic and a lot of the other decisions.
Yes.
Goldman Sachs and the other Wall Streeters.
Which, by the way, it's been under both of them. It goes back a long way.
Since Truman. I think Truman might have been the last one without a lot of business Wall Street types of people.
Well, and I mentioned this too, you know, because I was around. This is when I started doing journalism. I remember when the Tea Party came out. And I interviewed Tea Party people. By the way, Bannon was one of those. I didn't know him at the time, but he was one of those people. And Bannon is not a normal conservative. Steve Bannon's a guy I know. He was my mentor. He's a friend of mine. But he's not a normal conservative.
He's a fascinating guy. He's got a real
yes,
varied and diverse background in a lot of different things.
Yes, and he's talked about, for instance, raising taxes on the wealthy, which I actually don't have any problem with, particularly when it comes to raising taxes on the money people make through investments.
Right.
In other words, right now, investment income is simply not taxed the same way that earned income, income you get from working,
right,
is taxed.
Some, and
it's,
some, like,
it's not fair.
Right. Some capital gains are never taxed.
That's
They're just
right.
kind of held and used as leverage for loans, and people live off that appreciation. But until they
That's
realize
right.
the gains by selling it or transferring it, it's all—
It's not taxed.
Not taxed.
And people, and by the way—
People don't know that.
Democrats have figured this out. Republicans have figured this out. And people who play Democrat and Republican have figured this out. If you're very wealthy—
The Dinos and the Rhinos.
You figured that out. And so— The thing I noticed when I was first looking at the Tea Party, people forget this. The Tea Party, and I know a friend, my friend, I got to get my friend Christina on sometime. My friend Christina Batteri, I've known her 25 years. She was one of the founders of the Tea Party. When you talk to those people, they were upset about TARP and the bank bailouts because this is around the time that everything was collapsing.
And progressives were as well.
That's exactly right. And what happened very quickly was both the establishment Democrats and the establishment Republicans came in and co-opted that. The establishment Democrats said, oh, well, this whole Tea Party movement, it's all AstroTurf. Well, no, I interviewed Tea Party people. I went down. I was writing for Huffington Post at the time. When I talked to Tea Party people, they were intelligent, they were informed, and they were educated. Now, when I went to Occupy Wall Street and covered that, when I talked to people, I'm looking at people who are looking at the same problem. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
They're looking at the same problem, and they have a different solution. But in some cases, their inability to get together is based on the fact that the establishment of both parties don't want people to get together and realize the problem. They want to keep people separate. But anyway, the reason I mention that is that we have these signature stories that we cover, and the president, God bless him, Donald Trump last night apparently has been listening to the show.
Well, there's accusations that he's being controlled by this show.
Yes, that would be Louise Mensch. By the way, Louise, if you're listening, hi.
Hi, but, Louise.
Louise has built up about 275,000 followers by saying, by the way, I got to say this too. I'm just going to mention this. I don't want to do it in a whiny way. But when people say stuff to me on Twitter, like, because I work for a Sputnik.
Don't feed the trolls.
I'm not feeding the trolls, but on the other hand, when someone says, you're a traitor, we shoot traitors. That was said to me.
That's kind of a death threat.
That's kind of, it is. Well, yeah, right. That's the way I take it. Right?
Yep.
If someone, let's transfer it out. Someone says, you're Jewish, we shoot Jews.
Or
you're black, we shoot black. You're white, we shoot whites.
Yeah.
Right.
By the way, I reported
that to Twitter, and Twitter was like, yeah, it's not really a threat. Twitter was like, yeah, whatever.
Well, but if they said something like, you work for Twitter, we shoot people who work
right,
for Twitter.
Right, exactly right.
Oh, wait a minute.
Yes. I'm not willing to experiment and see how that goes.
No, I wouldn't suggest doing that.
But
just a thought experiment.
But Louise, that's, by the way, it's what.
And don't shoot people who work for Twitter. I'm sure they're very fine people. Don't shoot anybody.
Don't shoot anybody.
I'm
that's
against
a good,
that. I'm against
that's
that.
My policy.
Yeah.
Unless they're going to shoot you first, then
well,
maybe.
Self-defense.
But yeah, so that's the era that we're in now. But let's play the thing. I want to play Donald Trump, by the
this
way.
This is
Donald Trump is not listening to the show.
No, it's very unlikely.
But
he should.
He should be listening to the show.
And so should the people who are listening and their friends.
And we'll talk about why he can't in a second.
Okay, that'd be good.
No, I'll tell you why.
No, okay.
Let me just do it right now.
Okay. And then right after that, we'll go into that.
Do you know how crazy the media would go if Donald Trump said, I sat down with Sputnik co-host Lee Stranahan?
I heard the greatest thing on Sputnik radio. It was just the best show. Everybody tells me Trump, listen to Sputnik.
Yeah, I mean, but can you imagine how nuts the media would get? Because they already lie about Sputnik, and they say that Sputnik is pro-Trump.
He might do it to troll them.
I'm the only pro-Trump. That would be fantastic.
Just saying.
We're only a few blocks from the White House, Mr. President, if
we
you're
are.
Listening. Anytime.
We are.
Anytime.
It's close. We're
and
neighbors.
I've been in the White House plenty, but—
And you've been to Trump Towers.
I'm going to be again. I'm waiting for this August recess to go, and then I'm going to go— You know, he's out of town. He's in New Jersey. And I love this country, but not enough to go to New Jersey.
There's a lot of nice places in New Jersey.
There are. It was the easy joke, and I went for it. And I'm sorry. I'm a Springsteen fan, and I know all the—
What's your favorite exit?
You're exactly right. I know all of those jokes, and it was the easy joke, and I went for it. But let's play what the president said last night. Let's play this. The media is ignoring this. Let's play it.
Plus, the Democrats colluded on the Ukraine. So they colluded. And then when you get down to it, why isn't the FBI looking at the DNC server? You have a server that the Democrats refused to give to the FBI.
Now, so I want to say one thing about this, and then I want to hear your take on that, Mike. So I want to say this. Attention, listening audience. Do me a favor. If you're listening on 105.5, go full Blues Brothers and put a giant speaker on the top of your car right now, because I really want people to hear this. And I've said this before. I've done this on Periscope, but I want to make it clear. Pay attention, everybody. The media is lying to you. The American news media is lying to you. And the way they lie to you specifically is they ignore stories and they ignore facts that don't fit their narrative.
Yeah, that's the most subtle way of lying, is to just pretend something doesn't exist at all.
That's exactly right. And here's what it is. There's not a doubt in the world that the DNC colluded with the Ukrainians.
It's lying by omission.
And the reason we know that is because Politico, Ken Vogel, not a right-wing site.
And not an obscure— you know, this isn't like somebody's blog out of somewhere.
That's right.
You know, some backwater. Politico is one of the most read publications by members of Congress and the insiders in Washington.
But go look up what Trump talked about. Here's what I want you to do. Go to the New York Times.
Don't take our word for it.
Go to the Washington
Post. Don't take
Post.
Trump's word for it.
And by the way, go to Breitbart News, because Breitbart has not even done a good job of covering this. But go to the New York Times or the Washington
Fox
Post.
Fox hasn't really talked about it.
Go to— Fox has done a better job. Sean Hannity's brought this up, not in the way I would, but at least he's brought it up. Fox reported this last night. But the rest of the media, go to New York Times, go to the Washington Post, type in Ukraine, Alexandra Chalupa, and see how many stories you find. And what you'll find is they're burying details, including the fact they'll always— here's what the answer is on this, Mike. They'll say, well, all Ukraine did was report Paul Manafort's name being in a secret ledger in August.
Which wasn't true.
And the way we know it wasn't true is look this up.
After the election, they—
June 27th.
They recanted.
6 weeks ago, they recanted that. And you can look it up. And Bloomberg reported it, and nobody else reported it.
Bloomberg is not favorable to Trump.
Not at all. And by the way, Ukraine's not favorable to Trump. Ukraine— the same prosecutor who said, yeah, we found Manafort's name in a secret ledger, is the same prosecutor, the same guy who said, yeah, it wasn't there. Here's the other thing about this.
The prosecutor, is that an American prosecutor?
No, he's a
Ukrainian prosecutor.
He's a Ukrainian prosecutor. He said back in August, Paul Manafort, who was at the time Donald Trump's campaign chair, his name's in this ledger. Then he came out on June 27th in an interview that you can watch, and he said, yeah, no, his name wasn't— there's no record of cash payments to him. But the other thing about this, Mike, somebody sent me this on Twitter, because I say the media doesn't cover it. CNN did a story on Manafort back around June 27th, and literally that detail was in the last bottom paragraph of the CNN story, which every other paragraph was about Paul Manafort, smoke and mirrors. Paul Manafort, smoke and mirrors. They don't report that. The other thing is, go look up— I did a video. It's up on populist.tv. James Comey testified three times, twice in front of the Senate and once in front of the House, that the FBI asked the DNC for the server multiple times, and they refused to cooperate with the FBI. That's not me saying it. It's James Comey saying it. But watch how much this has been reported by the Times, by the Post, or, like I say, Breitbart News, who told me to stop going to the White House when I was trying to ask a question about this back in May. I had to quit Breitbart to do this. So this is all— I just want to get that out there for people, because you're going to hear arguments back. Oh, this or that. Go look into it for yourself. So, Mike, what's your take?
Well, I'm really glad that you brought this up, because I want to issue some advice, some loving advice
to me.
You wouldn't need this, because you're already doing this. But to the DNC, stop living by the investigation because you're going to die by the investigation.
Amen.
If you really think, and a lot of people think, and I respect a lot of people I respect think that there are ties between Trump and nefarious entities and, you know, Russia, whatever else. If you have confidence that these scandals have substance, that there's a cover-up going on, and I personally think there is a cover-up going on of what, I'm not sure. But don't get involved in hawking these conspiracies and cover-ups and all that. Don't think that you're going to be able to bring down Trump like Watergate brought down Nixon, because George W. Bush and Dick Cheney lied us into war and nothing came of it. They had 8 years in office. And Ronald Reagan.
And a lot
Reagan,
of people feel the same way about Hillary Clinton, and nothing's come of it.
And Ronald Reagan was involved in much worse than I've heard talked about than Watergate. And he served 8 years in office. There's been exactly zero presidents impeached and removed from office. And if that's your strategy, it's going to fail.
Yeah.
And do something to solve the problems that the country's facing. Get off the investigation.
And it does seem like the establishment strategy on both sides is just to do this. Anyway, Mike Hirsch has been joining us. Check him out. Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week on Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan.
Fault Lines.